love has to be local. We just, as individuals, it's just really hard. How do I love the environment? I don't know how to love the environment. I know how to love my part of the environment that I live on. I know how to love the Indian River Lagoon because that's what I know. I know the Indian River Lagoon. I have a relationship with the Indian River Lagoon because I spend so much time on it. And I know, for instance, when a hurricane comes through, I notice when channels have shifted or when new sandbars have developed or when particular mangroves have been squashed and new ones are springing up. And so I think that's one of the lessons I learned from lots of reading Wendell Berry, is that when we actually want to love and live out that love, it has to be in our local place. And so that's what we're really trying to do with Love Your Place, is provide the tools and the guidance to help all of us on this journey of learning how to build a healthy, right, flourishing relationship with wherever the place is that God has put us in for this season.
Welcome to the Earth Keepers Podcast. This podcast is for people who seek new and better ways to love and care for the earth. It's a podcast for anyone who is deeply concerned about the harm being done to the environment on a local and global level. It's a podcast that builds community and connection between people of like heart and mind, people who believe that earth care should be integrated into every aspect of life, and for many in the Earth Keepers community, that includes our spiritual lives. Welcome, friends, to the Earth Keepers Podcast. Hey, Earth Keepers. If you've spent any time at all engaging with this podcast, you know that we at Circlewood and at Earth Keepers feel a lot of resonance with a global faith-based conservation organization called Arasha. Earth Keepers has been hugely impacted by Arasha, in great part because of the profound formational influence that the organization's founders, Peter and Miranda Harris, had on me when I was a seminary student. So, fittingly, in the podcast, we frequently have featured Arasha voices, including that of my friend Leah Costimo of Arasha Canada way back in episode 5. In episode 62, we talked about carbon offsetting with Brittany Mikowski of Climate Stewards, a nonprofit and the Arasha family of organizations. And in episode 79, we spoke about hospitality and community with Joe Swinney, Communications Director at Arasha International and daughter of the organization's founders. Well, I'm happy to share yet another episode featuring an Arasha perspective. James and I will be talking with Ben Lowe, the Executive Director of Arasha USA, about his first year on the job and about his future vision for helping people to seek God's heart for the places where they live. James, my brother, I always look forward to these episodes that we get to host together, so welcome to you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here and looking forward to our conversation today.
Ben, welcome to you as well. James and I both have personal connections to Arasha, and we really love the work that the organization does, so we are looking forward to hearing about your future dreams for Arasha USA.
Thanks, Forrest and James. It's really great to be with you both. I'm also really glad to hear that you have a rich history and connection with us at Arasha. I'm curious, could you share more about that?
Yeah, I can say that for me, I took courses with Peter and Miranda Harris up at Regent College in BC, and they were hugely instrumental in helping me to reconcile my faith with creation care, because up to that point, I hadn't had very good models for that. So in some ways, they kind of set me free to pursue what actually has become a deep vocation for me. James, what about you?
Yeah, I've known about Arasha for a little over a decade, and in 2016, I was able to spend a couple of days with the Arasha Canada folks at what was then called the Brooksdale Environmental Center in Surrey. And just being welcomed into that community, working the agricultural fields with them, talking about their vision and dreams and hopes, and kind of looking over what they had done, was really one of the more inspiring moments for me that pushed me to think about doing something different with my vocational life. And when I look back, I think that's a significant experience in the formation of Circlewood. I'm really glad for folks who have gone before me, like Arasha, and I can say they influenced me and the direction of Circlewood right now to this day.
That's really great to hear.
Ben, to help our listeners to get oriented, perhaps you could tell us in a general sense about Arasha and the work that the organization does.
Yeah, sure. Well, it's great to hear about your connection with the organization, and I'm not surprised at all. Arasha, in many ways, was that for me as well. As someone who grew up in the Christian faith, caring for creation had been a blind spot in most of my own experience in the church, and it was really getting involved in Arasha that opened my eyes to see what God is doing in the world and the ways that I and other Christians around the world can join in on that. So Arasha has been around for 40 years. It's a network of Christian environmental conservation organizations. We're on 6 continents. We have national organizations in over 20 countries, including here in the U.S. and including, as you both experienced, in Canada. And we really love and value our colleagues in Canada. They're doing really good work across that country. We have a growing network of friends of Arasha organizations in now over 20 other countries and contexts. So there are a lot of Arashas all around the world and lots of opportunities to see what God's doing and get involved in that work. I help lead Arasha in the United States, and we've been active in this country for a bit over 20 years now. Our mission is to live out God's call to care for creation and to equip others to do likewise. And so we do that through the conservation projects that we have. We have one in Florida on the Indian River Lagoon that I can share more about. We have one in Central Texas in the Austin area that's doing really, really great work there. And we've got some other projects that are in earlier stages of coming online that I'd love to be able to share about down the road once they're more fully established. But of course, not everybody lives in Central Florida or Central Texas. So we've been working very hard to offer different resources and tools and opportunities for folks to connect and be involved in caring for God's creation, no matter where they live in the U.S. and increasingly around the world.
That's great. And that's really inspiring work that you're doing. And I'm thinking about your current role leading the United States branch of Arasha and wondering what influences, what experiences, what people kind of led you to that point, because you have an international background, you've had educational opportunities, you could have done a lot of things. What are the key moments or key people or influences that led you to this role at this time?
That's a great question, and I'm not sure I'll be able to do it justice in a short time because there are many. But I suppose for me, my connection to Arasha really started during my undergraduate years. I went to a Christian liberal arts college outside of Chicago called Wheaton. And when I was there, we started a student chapter of Arasha. One of our professors, Fred Van Dyke, was on the board of Arasha USA at the time, and Arasha USA itself was just getting started. And so it was starting a student chapter and connecting with other Christians around the world through Arasha who had similar callings and passions and were doing similar work that really got me rooted in the Arasha community. And then when I graduated, Arasha USA hired me for a couple years. I worked for them in the U.S. doing outreach on college campuses and other communities. And so it was my first job, which is great. And as you alluded to, James, I then went on and worked in a number of other contexts. I worked for the Evangelical Environmental Network. I did stuff with the Salvo Institute. I helped start Young Evangelicals for Climate Action. But through it all, I was very much still connected to the Arasha community, the global perspective it brings and the global connections. As someone who grew up outside the United States, Singapore, that was really important and valuable to me as well. And so when an opportunity came up for me to get back involved with Arasha, which came during the end of my doctoral time, I was very eager to pursue it. At first, I was working at the International Office, which is the coordinating body for all the Arasha national organizations around the world. And that was a really rich experience that taught me a lot. But at the same time, I felt this unexpected pull back to the United States toward what had become my own community and my own country and my own place. And I really wanted to have a chance to invest more in all the really important and strategic urgent work that we have to do here. And so when Arasha USA announced it was looking for a new executive director, I surprised myself. I jumped at the opportunity to come back, and they had me. So here I am.
So you're new to the role, relatively speaking, and I'm sure that you are in the dreaming and scheming phase. I'm wondering if you could talk about what are your dreams at this point for Arasha USA in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you. I'm about 8 months in. So in some ways, still new in some ways, not new enough to have the same excuses as when I was a week in. But I think even these past 8 months, we've seen tremendous progress. And this connects to some of the research I did before when I was in academia, and we were looking at some of the generational shifts taking place among American Christians, including American evangelicals, with younger generations much more aware and concerned about environmental issues, about climate change, about biodiversity loss, and wanting the church to get more involved. And so we've experienced that at Arusha. We've seen it. When I first started in this work over 20 years ago, a lot of our focus was trying to persuade Christians that there were problems in God's world with the environment and the rest of creation, and that as Christians, we should care about those problems. These days, that has shifted. I know that conversation still is happening and needs to happen in lots of places and times, but now we're finding more and more people, more and more churches coming to us saying, we are really concerned. We see what's going on in God's world. We see what's going on in our own neighborhoods and communities on the environmental front, and we feel called to do something about it, but we don't know what to do. We've never been equipped. And so really our focus has now shifted more towards connecting Christians who care about these issues and providing the support, the resources, the community for us to shift our growing concern and sometimes anxiety and despair into meaningful, sustained, and hopeful action together over the long term. So that was a bit of a long ramble. I just want to flag three specific dreams I have for Arusha, one which is well on the way. The first is that I'm really hopeful that we'll finally be able to launch a really good, strong church partners program for congregations around the U.S. And I'm so excited to share that we just received a very generous grant from the Lilly Endowment to do that. So we're building that program as we speak, and it should be online later this year. The next thing that I'm really hopeful that we'll be able to achieve in the nearer to midterm is to build out our work in Florida on the Indian River Lagoon, which is a place very dear to my heart, the most biodiverse estuary system in the United States, but also one of the more threatened. And I'd really love to have an opportunity for us to build out a hub there and maybe a more physical long-term presence. And then the last thing to say is, I'm just really excited about the opportunity we have in this season to collaborate with many other groups like us who are doing similar work. We've entered into really fruitful collaborations with groups like BioLogos, Asabel, Plant with Purpose, and of course, Circlewood, and would love to figure out how we can continue to work together. And it was a real joy late last year to be able to visit Camino Island with James and get to see the land that you guys are working on.
And I wanted to follow up on something that you said about the shift in emphasis, maybe away from that more persuasive mission of getting churches to understand that there is a problem, more toward equipping churches to respond. That makes me hopeful to hear you say that. I'm wondering, what is it that you have seen in terms of that shift, and maybe what's behind the shift? Why is it that people are coming around the idea that, yes, there is a problem with climate change, with all kinds of environmental issues, and that the church does have a responsibility and an opportunity to get involved?
It's a big question. I'm not sure that I know all of the reasons, but what we do see from the research is part of it appears to be generational, a generational shift with younger generations less stuck in the old culture war mentalities of the past and more keen to figure out how we can re-engage our relationship with those who are different from us as well as with the rest of creation. So I think the generational shift is one encouraging piece that we're seeing. But there's also some sobering reasons, which is that the state of the world and the state of the planet has gotten, in many ways, it's gotten more dire and more visible over the last 10 to 20 years. And so a lot of folks are not just seeing things in the news happening around the world, which I think does get our attention, but we're also experiencing and witnessing some of these things, these climate disruptions, these extreme weather events, the impacts of environmental degradation and pollution in our own neighborhoods and communities and in our own families. And so that gets our attention as well. Groups like Arusha, groups like Circlewood, we don't come completely out of a vacuum. God has always been working in his church to engage us in the needs and the opportunities of caring for the rest of creation. And over these past decades within the United States, there have been a lot of theologians and a lot of different organizations and ministries that have been working to engage God's people on these issues. And I'm hopeful that that's helped build the foundation. We certainly have a really rich theological foundation across many different Christian traditions and denominations that equipped us and prepare us to help know how to relate with the rest of creation and how to show up in times like this. So I think those are some of the reasons why we're seeing this shift. And I do find it really encouraging as well. And I know there's still so much work to do, and there's still a lot of persuasive conversations that need to happen. But I don't think we can keep us or slow us down from doing the work that God has given us to do in this season.
Then just a follow-up question to that. First, my own observation that one of the things that is changing some of the culture within our churches and communities is people having encounters with the more than human world that are moving, whether that's seeing some of the damage that has been done or feeling it firsthand, or being open to more experiences of awe and wonder by getting outside and into the world a little bit more deeply. I'm curious what your personal experience has been. What is it that motivates you? What encounters, experiences keep you grounded in the earth and passionate about your work?
This has been my relationship with the rest of creation, and my interest and passion for the environment began when I was a child growing up in Singapore and Malaysia. My mom's Malaysian and I was born in Singapore. My parents worked there. And it was really what you just alluded to. It was both the great value and the gift that I experienced of being in nature, as well as the sobering lessons I learned and the concerns I had from seeing the effects of unsustainable development, for instance, in my communities. And so it was really growing up on the mud flats on the coast of Malaysia, my mom's hometown, during low tide, chasing mud skippers across the pools and waiting for local fisher folks to bring in their catch and sorting through it with them and learning about all the different things they were catching and the uses that they had in our community. All of those are really formative, but I also saw that when the land and the water isn't healthy, people aren't healthy. And as a follower of Jesus, I'm really concerned with God's creation, and I'm also concerned with the well-being of my neighbors. The greatest commandment that we've been given is to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbors as ourselves. And I came to learn from those experiences at a very early age that I can't do either. I can't love God without loving the rest of the world that God made and loves and sustains and is part of his plan. And I can't love my neighbor unless I care about the issues that are affecting the well-being and health and flourishing of so many human communities around the world, including mine. So it was from a very young age for me. And then moving to the United States from a place like Singapore, which is a huge global city, moving to the United States, I was just blown away by the amount of open, less developed spaces that we have. And I just loved the opportunity to go hiking and to climb mountains and to explore estuaries. And so I had family members who've lived in South Florida for a long time on the Indian River Lagoon. And that's how my relationship with the Indian River Lagoon first got started. And I spent countless hours in kayaks and canoes floating around the mangroves and on the seagrass beds and just exploring all that the Indian River Lagoon has to offer.
Ben, I'm intrigued by your mention of your Malaysian heritage. And our podcast is really global in the sense that we believe that we need perspectives from all different cultures to help us fully understand not only the problems that we face in terms of creation care, but also the opportunities. I wonder if you could speak about what it is that your Malaysian part of you, how it affects your perspective, how it affects your work. Is there something really distinctly Malaysian in your approach to creation care?
Well, my family is, on my mom's side, a Cantonese background. So we're Chinese Malaysian in particular. And a couple of things that stood out to me that I didn't really fully recognize because that was just my culture, right? It was really when I came to the U.S. and I saw and lived in a culture that was very different in many ways that I started to recognize some of the great assets and values that my upbringing instilled in me. And one was just the importance of community and the collective. And so my more traditional Chinese upbringing in context, it wasn't nearly as individualistic by a long shot as in the United States. And so we understood that it wasn't just about us as individuals, it was about the well-being of, in many cases, the family or the community or the kampong, the village that my mom grew up in. And so thinking about things from that broader perspective and considering the importance of the collective, both in terms of things we should care about, but also in terms of the resources that we have to care about them. Not only should we care about things that affect our broader communities, but we actually can work with our broader communities and our families to care about them instead of just taking a more individualistic focus. That was a really big one. I think another piece that I've wanted to dig into more, and I haven't been able to yet, but maybe this will help prompt me to go back, is the idea of harmony, which is really important to me. And I recognize that as I do my work, that harmony is really important to me. And I understand harmony as right relationships between me and God, my creator, right relationships between me and my neighbors, between me and the rest of creation, and within me, and my relationship with myself. And that's a very completely biblical concept to think about the work that we do here as being so relational and the importance of what Jesus did to reconcile and to provide a way to reconcile our relationship with God and thus with the rest of creation as well.
I just have an observation about Ben's response that it echoes a lot of what we hear from our indigenous friends around the world, that concept of shalom or harmony. I'm thinking of Randy Woodley and his book, Shalom and the Community of Creation. And I think and hope that that perspective will find a greater foothold in Western culture. I think people are open to it. I think they're hungry for it, but they don't always have the words or the cultural framework for it. Then I guess my follow-up question would be, do you see people in the West talking more like that and having more of an understanding of that more comprehensive harmony?
Well, I think to the extent that we do, I think it's really folks like Dr. Woodley and other leaders from different traditions and backgrounds than the typical Western white culture in particular that have helped to call out some of those blind spots and help to re-educate and fill some of those gaps for us. I really loved and appreciated his book and my teaching that I get to do on the side. I usually assign readings from Braiding Sweetgrass for very similar themes and very similar reasons. And I found that with all my students and the people I talk with, at the very least, even if there's not recognition when we start talking about it, there's a real hunger for what these perspectives are helping to bring, and a recognition very quickly that these are things that are really important and have been neglected because we've been more siloed and we've kind of approached issues from within our particular context without necessarily being as intentional about cultivating and making sure that we were hearing from all the voices that needed to be represented.
I'm curious about Arusha's USA website, which reads from the very get-go, Restoring People and Places Through Biodiversity, Conservation, and Ecological Action. So one might expect an organization like yours to focus on places, but you've included people in this statement. Why is that? And how do you understand the relationship between the restoration of people and places?
That was very intentional on our part. And it was also aspirational. I think we recognize the importance and we're trying to learn and grow and figure out how to live into that better. But it's coming from the very simple truth that we are creatures. We are a part of creation. And there's often a real pull that we experience in the way we've structured our societies to separate us from the rest of creation. You know, we don't as much grow our food anymore, most of us anyway. We go to the supermarket and we don't see where it comes from and what it takes to get through our plates when we throw out our waste at the curb or recycle. It just gets picked up and it goes away. We don't know when we flush the toilet what happens unless we're very intentional about figuring it out. And so at the very basic level, what we're trying to acknowledge is that we are a part of creation. Even if our species is distinct in some very important theological ways, the implications of which help guide the role that we serve in on behalf of God and the rest of creation. Nonetheless, we are a part of creation. And if we want to get back to and cultivate shalom and flourishing and harmony, there is no true shalom and flourishing and harmony that does not include right relationships between us and the rest of creation. And so that might sound a bit abstract, but maybe one particular example from the work that we do in our Texas project in the Austin area, led by our director there, Dr. Veronica Godoy. She works with her community, the Hispanic community, and organizes a program called Picnics en el Arroyo, which are these Saturday field days that she organizes for Hispanic families in local natural areas. And a lot of these folks are recent immigrants to the United States. They're facing a lot of challenging circumstances. They're trying to figure out how to get by and settle in here. And they've often been displaced from their own home places. And so what these picnic days do is they give folks a safe opportunity as a whole family to get together and get to know the new place that is their new home. And we do environmental education, we do nature immersion activities, games, there's food. And what we've come to see is by helping to provide a friendly space for our neighbors to connect with the creation around them, it does a lot of good for their families. It doesn't just help them connect and know the names of more species of trees and birds and sometimes snakes, which are always very exciting. But it also gives them an opportunity to connect with each other in a much less stressful environment where they're being hosted and where they're experiencing the hospitality of God's people, but also of the rest of creation. And so we really see that the importance of people and place.
So by implication then, what you're saying in some ways is that what's good for the environment, what's good for nature, is also good for people. I think that that relationship sort of begins to break down the barrier that you can't really separate humankind and non-human creation, that their well-being, their development, their shalom, as it were, is intricately connected. Is there something about biodiversity in particular that makes a difference to that equation? Again, conservation of biodiversity is part of your mission. Why biodiversity?
We emphasize that in some ways, not because it's the whole picture, but because it's often been particularly neglected in the church and sometimes even in some of the environmental spaces. And we're keen to take what, in some of my writings, I've used the term theocentric or theocentrism. We're keen to take God's view of the world and God's approach and to center God. Sometimes there's this tension between what's more important, people or other species or people or the environment. And what we're trying to say is God's most important. God's in the center of our calling and of our reality. And it's only by keeping God at the center that we can really have right relationship with everything else. So that said, biodiversity is really an integral component of all that, because without healthy ecosystems that are flourishing, without biodiversity, then we're not going to have things that we need to survive. So things like food and water and arable land to produce things on and everything like that. We're very much dependent on nature, and we're in a period of history where we are witnessing another great mass extinction, but one that, unlike all the previous ones, aren't caused by natural causes. This one's unique in that it's caused by us, by the very people created in the image of God to care for these things that we are exterminating and destroying at a very unwise and very alarming rate. And so what we are trying to also do is highlight the crisis that we have before us, which a lot of scientists have been calling the thinning of life, which is that we're not only losing species, but we're also losing their abundance in many places.
I'm struck by the difficulty it can be to communicate the big picture, talk about what's happening across the planet, talk about these big theological ideas and shifts and changes that we need to make, while at the same time needing to make practical change on sometimes a small and local level. And I think your projects in places like Texas and Florida are a great example of that. But you've also done something by putting together the Love Your Place program that's attempting to help people figure out how to do that in their particular places as well. And I'm thinking about the challenge of that, because it can't be a one-size-fits-all. Just do these three things, no matter where you are, and it'll all be good. You have to tailor these approaches to the particular places people live. How do you go about that through something like Love Your Place?
It's really important, and it's really not easy in some ways, because we have so much that we have forgotten or that we need to relearn. And so Love Your Place was started a number of years ago here in the U.S., and it's an attempt to help provide a space for folks who are keen to learn how to love their place and reconnect with their place again, to come and be resourced and equipped, and also to meet others on the journey. Because part of what we need to is just encouragement and community. It's really hard to do a lot of this work alone as good as it is. And so I'm really glad to share that we've been getting a lot of really constructive and helpful feedback from people who've been part of Love Your Place and from some of the best thinkers and writers on how to equip folks using a remote platform like this. And we're in the mid to late stages of revising, revamping, and overhauling Love Your Place. And I'm really excited about the new shape it's taking. So again, sorry, but stay tuned. More to say on that down the line. But I think the big picture is that all love has to be local. We just, as individuals, it's just really hard. How do I love the environment? I don't know how to love the environment. I know how to love my part of the environment that I live on. I know how to love the Indian River Lagoon because that's what I know. I know the Indian River Lagoon. I have a relationship with the Indian River Lagoon because I spend so much time on it. And I know, for instance, when a hurricane comes through, I notice when channels have shifted or when new sandbars have developed or when particular mangroves have been squashed and new ones are springing up. And so I think that's one of the lessons I learned from lots of reading Wendell Berry, is that when we actually want to love and live out that love, it has to be in our local place. And so that's what we're really trying to do with Love Your Place, is provide the tools and the guidance to help all of us on this journey of learning how to build a healthy, right, flourishing relationship with wherever the places that God has put us in for this season.
It seems to me that behind your words is this assumption that to become good earth keepers, to become lovers of our places, that there's almost a personal transformation element of it. We've got to become the kind of people who notice, the kind of people who know what to look for, and the kind of people who can develop a creative response to the needs that we see. What would your advice be to people just in terms of becoming? How does one make those personal transformations to be in a better place, to be a carer for creation, a lover of place?
I like how you phrased it. And I think I would continue it by saying, I think what we're talking about is we need to become more like Jesus. And you look at the example of Christ that we have in the scriptures, and he came to a very particular place and he knew his place and he taught from his place and he ministered to his communities within the context of a particular place. And I think part of the opportunity that we have so many resources to pursue this that sometimes that bit gets overwhelming, just trying to figure out where to start, but it's just starting to get to know our place. And this is why this is the journey that we try to help people pursue through the Love Your Place program, because it's not a one-size-fits-all, as you alluded to, because every place is different, every person is different, every community is different. And so it has to be very context-specific, but there are underlying questions or themes or approaches that can help guide us and cultivate that wherever we are. And so just starting to get to know the other species that live around us, and the names of the trees and the birds and what seasons they're here and what seasons they're gone, and then starting to spend time in our places, off our screens and outside of our homes, but actually starting to relate to the rest of creation. And then we can go from thinking about not just having a smaller environmental footprint. We talk about that a lot sometimes in this space, where we want to have a less negative impact on the rest of creation by having a smaller environmental footprint. But we also want to think about how we can have a more positive impact on the rest of creation by increasing our environmental handprint. It's not just how to be less of a curse, right? But how to be more of a blessing. And so one ritual that I've sort of adopted over time is I do a lot of beach walks. I can in Florida. It's one of the great joys of living in Florida, is I can just walk along a beach for miles and pray and reflect and think and just pay attention. And one of the things I've started to do is I've started to bring a trash bag, because there's always trash that washes up. A lot of it's plastic. A lot of it looks a lot like jellyfish, which is turtle food. And so just as I'm walking and I'm praying, I'm picking up trash and putting it into my bag. And for me, that becomes an act of service to the rest of creation, but to God in particular. It's who I'm offering it to. And so in that sense, it also becomes an act of worship.
I love this idea that there's a relational component to becoming a good earth keeper. I'm having a flashback actually to an interview we did with Victoria Lures several years ago. She's been instrumental to help us to learn about the answers to these questions. She's the founder of the Wild Church movement, one of the co-founders. Anyway, what she told us way back then was one of her disciplines is she had a cedar tree that she would simply go and sit with. and just spending time with the tree was her way of learning not only about her place and the essence of her place, but even forming a relationship that then led to action, which I think is kind of what you're talking about as well.
Absolutely. A lot of environmental work is sometimes motivated, at least in part, by fear or guilt. And I think these all have healthy roles, but they're not going to sustain us. What's going to sustain us is love. And it's been often said, I think it was my friend Stephen Bomer-Prediger who coined it, and let's see if I can get it right on the spot. You will not care for what you do not love, and you will not love what you do not know. I think I did an okay job of representing that. Part of it is getting to know and love your places, and then your action starts to flow from that. Your motivation can be sustained by that.
Ben, I think you get that absolutely right, because you could create a program called Care for Your Place, which would be helpful and practical, as Love Your Place is, but there's something about that intrinsic shift and that intrinsic motivation that if the love is there, you will figure out the care.
Yep, and it will see you through the many dark and discouraging days that we experience in this life and in this world, because there is great brokenness and things aren't the way they should be. And sometimes we pour our lives out to invest in a particular calling and we don't see much in the way of encouraging results. It's not that it means it's not worthwhile to do, and it's not that it means God isn't calling us to do it. And so what we really need is we need to figure out how to keep the right perspective and continually allow the Holy Spirit to renew our minds so that we can more and more have the mind of Christ as we approach this world, and also see God at work in the world, which is what gives me great encouragement when I know that as much as I care for my family members and my friends, I trust that God cares for them even more perfectly and loves them more perfectly than I ever will be able to. And so when my friends or my family are experiencing trouble, a lot of times it's stuff that's out of my control. And so as I try to support and journey with them through it, I offer that up to God. And I trust that God sees and hears and cares way more than I will ever be able to do. And I think about that in the same way for the rest of creation too, and the places that I love. The Indian River Lagoon, it's just a remarkable place. And there's so much beauty there, but there's also so much pollution and there's so much damage being done. Every time I go visit it, I see new signs of destruction. And so it really, it's living in that tension and leaning on God to give us the strength and the encouragement and the inspiration to keep plugging away.
Ben, in addition to getting outside and learning and working for the good of one's place and developing those capacities to love, I'm thinking about furthering one's education in this, and wondering if there is a book or two that you might recommend to our listeners who want to dive a little bit deeper into this. And I will ask you to include one of your own.
There are so many great books out there. It's going to be hard to pick. Well, the book of late that I've already referenced that I found really encouraging and helpful for me, but also really encouraging and helpful for the students that I get to teach, is Braiding Sweetgrass. So it's a book not written from a Christian perspective, but I think with great value and great alignment with how God calls us to live in this world and see the world around us. So that's a resource that I often recommend and share with folks. In terms of one of my books, that's also hard to pick, but I think Doing Good Without Giving Up is the second book I wrote, and I wrote it after being in this work for 10 years, so I was still relatively young. Some folks thought it was pretty presumptuous that I would write a book with that title at that age, and they're not wrong. But even after being in this work for 10 years, I looked around, and a lot of the friends who I started out with had kind of drifted off for many different reasons. Some of them chose to settle down, and a lot of that fire and that sense of calling and purpose and mission that they had that had launched them into the work in the early days wasn't there anymore. And there's a friend who was almost embarrassed to share with me that they thought they had sold out in life. And so after being in this work for 10 years, I was looking back at all the lessons that I learned from watching many different people who have been in the journey much longer than me, and wanting to figure out what would it look like for me to be able to stay in this journey for another 10, 20, 30, 40 years. what can I learn from my experience and what can I learn from the experiences of so many others present, but also past. So I wrote that book as much for me as for anybody else. And I think there are some things that I've learned since then, but I don't think there's anything in that book that I think was horribly wrong. So maybe that would be one to recommend.
Well, I have to say, though, that the criticism that you were too young to write such a book makes no sense to me, because of all the people in the world who have to grapple with that question of how to have hope, it's the young, right? Because they ultimately are going to be paying the most expensive or the hardest price for the damage that's ongoing now. And we know from our experience, James and I, that it's hard for youth to see a bright future. It's hard for them to find sometimes motivation to press on.
Yeah, I agree. I saw that. So thanks for saying that. That's a helpful counter perspective.
Yeah, I think disappointment and disillusionment for many come early.
It makes me wonder, I don't know how old you are, but you're not old. I'm wondering if that actually is yet another cause for hope, that you're bringing a younger perspective into this conversation about birth care.
Yeah, I hope so. Certainly one that's been formed by many really great teachers and activists and prophets throughout the scriptures, but also in our present time.
So Ben, we like to ask all of our guests on Earth Keepers the same question about hope. And that is, what sustains you? What keeps your hope going? And what would you share with our listeners to help them in their moments when they might be tempted to despair and lose a little hope?
Maybe a couple thoughts from social science about hope. One is that we find that when we start doing things, that generates hope for us. So it's sort of counterintuitive, but folks who tend to despair the most are often folks who aren't engaged actively in the solutions. And so as we do take those steps forward and we do get involved, it actually helps us increase our hope. The other thing is just that there are kind of two basic components to hope from a social scientific perspective. One is that you have to have an envisioned positive outcome down the road. And the other is that you have to have a pathway that you believe will get you there, even if it's hard. It can be really hard and it can look impossible, but if you think there's a chance that you'll get to that positive vision, then you can have hope. And I think that's where more and more I am really encouraged by a lot of technological and economic, political progress that I'm seeing in the world and that we're witnessing, and that really does make a difference. But at the end of the day, I think my hope doesn't rest in our species on our own, but my hope really rests in the character of God and trusting and God's love for this world and God's determination, as demonstrated throughout scriptures and into our present time, God's determination not to give up on the world that he made, but to save it.
We've been in conversation with Dr. Ben Lowe, Executive Director of Arasha USA. To learn more about Ben and Arasha, and to find helpful links to some of the topics we touched on in our conversation, please go to this episode's show notes at earthkeepers.online. The Earth Keepers podcast is an expression of Circlewood, an organization committed to cultivating a more ecologically conscious faith. For more information about the podcast, or to learn about the ways you can support this work, go to our website at earthkeepers.online. You can contact us by leaving a voicemail through the podcast website or by emailing us at earthkeepers@circlewood.online. I am Forrest Dinsley, your podcast host. James Amidon is our executive producer. Our content editor and researcher is Colleen Meggerly, and our sound engineer is Dave Wolfers. Jesselyn Gentry is our social media director, and Forrest Reed is the composer of our original music. Thank you for listening, friends, and please join us for our next conversation on the Earth Keepers podcast.